And now, KSCO presents Georgia. If you'd like to participate in our program today, give us a call at area code 831-479-1080. That's 479-1080. And now, KSCO presents Georgia.
Good afternoon and welcome to KSCO 1080 AM. My name is Georgia and I am your host for KSCO Presents. It is Wednesday, April 10th, and I welcome and thank all of you who are listening to us on the dial or streaming us live on KSCO.com. And hello to my trusty favorite engineer, Sam Quentin. Hi, Sam.
How are you doing today, Georgia?
I'm good because we have a fabulous show today,
Sam. Oh, I'm raring to go for this one.
Yeah, this is a good show today, Sam.
You bet.
Okay, so we are very proud to be a part of one of the last bastions of an independently owned radio station, thanks to the Swirling family. This allows those of us who are dedicated to try to sort out the truth and report news, opinions, and have discussions that you are not likely to hear through the mainstream media. The mainstream media appears to be asleep at the wheel. A free investigative press is one of the pillars of a healthy democracy. However, if the paid professionals are not going to do their jobs, that task falls to those who are interested in investigating, asking the questions in pursuit of the truth. Shedding light is the best disinfectant, and that is what we will attempt to do today. I think this is one of the most interesting, complicated, and disturbing stories of the decade, and I am delighted to be able to share it with our listeners. Now, Facebook is one of the most recognizable names today. This story may change Facebook as we know it. A court has decided that Facebook infringed on 11 of 11 claims of a patent filed by my guest, Mike McKibben, the CEO and founder of Leader Technologies. Mr. McKibben says this patent is the foundation of Facebook, the source code. It is what runs the engine of Facebook. So, is Facebook the evil twin of Leader Technologies? Oh, what a tangled web we weave when we first practice to deceive. Welcome to KSCO, Mike.
It's time to turn on the lights in the kitchen and watch the cockroaches scurry.
That's right, Sam. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Georgia. How are you?
I'm great. Welcome to KSCO, and thank you so much for being here with us today.
You're welcome.
Mike, this is a fantastically interesting and complicated story, so we're going to try to explain it to the listeners in a simplified way if we can. This is your case against Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook, right?
That's correct. Against Facebook specifically.
Right, exactly. So, Mike, why don't we start? What I want to do today is go back in time, if we can, and take this in chronological order so that the listeners can understand the events, when and how they occurred. And I'm going to ask my listeners, who are wonderful callers, to hold off on your calls until you've heard the story. And then we will open up the lines to hear what you have to say. And I know you'll have something to say, either comments, questions, whatever. But let's let Mike's story be told before we start opening up the phone line. So how does that sound, Mike?
That sounds good.
Okay, so let's go back, Mike, to 1997 when you founded Leader Technologies in Columbus, Ohio. You, at that time, said there were only 10 million people using the Internet, right?
That's approximately the number, yes.
Yeah. So you saw an opportunity here, right, Mike? And you want to tell us about that?
I did. In the mid-90s, in a prior company that I had, I had the opportunity to assist AT&T in rebuilding their email system.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, if you recall, back when Microsoft first announced Windows 95, this was a system that AT&T needed to run their email system on the Windows platform. So we worked with closely with Bell Labs and built that.
Mm-hmm.
And I left that company and said, there's got to be a better way to do this. And had an idea that the at that time, you'll also recall, there were these browser wars between Netscape and Internet Explorer. So there was a lot of foment around how the Internet was going to develop. But in the midst of that, I had some specific ideas for how we could use this emerging Internet technology to collaborate better on a large scale. And mm-hmm. I had supported many of the large-scale operations within AT&T and with key customers mm-hmm. With my company. So essentially in 97, I formed Leader Technologies to research and develop a program or an application that would use this emerging Internet technology to help people better collaborate. At that time, there was no sense of a name called social networking. I focused on leadership issues as one of the primary objectives of organizations to how they could better lead their organizations. So I put together a team of developers, which I would put up against anybody in the country. And we essentially went underground and we said, we're not coming out until we figure out what's wrong with large-scale collaboration. And we specifically want to focus it on the emerging Internet. Well, this was before Google. This was back when there were less than 10 million users. And so obviously it was not the time to introduce the product at that point. So we were inventing.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I was going to say security and privacy was one of your main important goals, wasn't it, Mike?
Well, absolutely. When you've got any kind of large-scale platform, security and privacy issues are front and center for any organization and any individual. So those were two bedrock design criteria that we worked on embedding into this invention, which the public knows part of it now, called social networking, but it was much larger than that at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we knuckled down. We raised our own money. We started writing code. We started doing research, and that took a number of years. So we did that all the way through the 2000s into 2002. When we felt like we had the code in good shape, we decided to file for patents, because at that point it was still early days for any kind of commercial exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we did. And we sought experts in Washington who were experts at trade secrets and patents and copyrights. And we asked them to assist us in properly protecting our technology through the patenting process.
Now, Mike, when you file a patent, which you did in 2002, how long is that patent protected before it becomes published? Is it protected till publishing, or how does that work for those of us who don't know?
The date, the clock on the date starts when you file the patent.
Okay.
And there's 20 years from the time you file.
Oh, all right.
So the time it takes for the patent office to get through the patent counts against your 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
The patent office will often give you some of that time back, depending on whether they were slow or whatever. So sometimes you get awarded additional time, but it's a 20-year time frame for the monopoly that the U.S. government gives you on a new invention.
Okay, because that's an important piece of this puzzle, isn't it?
Right.
Okay, so now, Mike, you say that it took 145,000 man hours and a $10 million investment to create the technology that we're talking about here today with Facebook. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And Mr. Zuckerberg claims he did it in 2 weeks while studying for finals at Harvard. Now, Mike, how realistic is that?
Well, you know, that's been one of the great puzzles in the Facebook story all these years. Why the media has not asked this question? That has come up several times, and I think the main reason is because most people don't understand how software development works. So they wouldn't know whether that's possible, that's credible, or whether he's just a very fast programmer. You know, nobody would know these things.
Or a genius.
Yeah. But even a genius can't write code that fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting.
The average programmer, you know, maybe 2 to 1,000 lines of code a day. Well, our code had over 500,000 lines of code in it.
Mm.
So the idea that somebody, while they're attending school, could build a large-scale platform that could go public on February 4, 2003, from a development standpoint, is just not a credible story. But, again, the general public wouldn't know whether it's credible or not. So mm-hmm. I understand why that's never really been scrutinized.
Yes. Okay, now, Mike, in 2003... you issued technical white papers. Tell the listeners what white papers are.
Okay. When you're filing for a patent, one of your obligations in filing for your patent, as soon as you've filed for it, you're supposed to start describing your technology so that the public can benefit.
Uh-huh.
And so one of the ways you can do that with technology, which people can't necessarily kick and touch and feel, is you write about it. And so one of the ways you write about that in software development is you write white papers, which are basically technical descriptions, high-level technical descriptions of what it is your software is doing, who it benefits, how it's built, those kinds of things.
Okay.
So you get into details.
Okay. So that was the details of the work that you had done with the 145,000 hours, right?
That's right.
Okay. Now, here's where it gets very interesting, folks. That was done in 2003. The white papers were issued. Now, Mike McKibben emailed the technical white paper to his son at Harvard on October 22nd, 2003. His son was a student adjacent to Mark Zuckerberg's dorm. Am I correct, Mike? Your son was there on campus.
That's right.
At the
they
same
were in
time.
The dorms. They were in the dorms next to each other.
Okay.
Did Kirkland House and Winthrop House.
Okay. Did they know each other, Mike? Either one of the boys? Or did Mark Zuckerberg know of Leader Technology at that point?
Well, I can't speak to what Mr. Zuckerberg did or didn't know, but I've asked my son that, and he was generally aware. Harvard isn't a big campus, and especially when people are going to and from classes. So
mm-hmm.
he was aware of some of the actors in the Facebook story. He doesn't recall knowing Zuckerberg, but you know, there was a general awareness of who he was.
Okay.
Because he was in that dorm a lot.
Okay. All right, so now we get to the infamous hacking that occurred on October 28th in 2003, right?
That is information that was made public in the Winklevoss twin case, the ConnectU case, a number of years ago. So we've been able to see Mark Zuckerberg's deposition and also an online diary describing that event, yes.
Okay. Were you aware that your white paper had been hacked at that time, or when did you find out?
Oh, we weren't aware of that. We weren't aware of Facebook. We weren't aware of Zuckerberg or anything like that.
Okay.
This has all come out many, many, many years later.
All right. All right, now we move to Leader conducts confidential beta tests with several firms, including clients of Accel Partners, throughout October of 2003. Is that Jim Breyer? Who is Accel Partners?
Well, Accel Partners is in Palo Alto, and
okay.
I believe Jim Breyer is the managing director or managing partner.
Okay, because he becomes a huge investor in Facebook, right?
Yes, that's very public.
Okay. All right, so Facebook is launched in February of 2004. Leader's patent application publishes in June of 2004.
Right.
So let's pick it up there.
Well, hindsight's
much
more informative than that. At the time, we weren't aware at all of anything that Facebook was doing. In fact, I think maybe my son had mentioned something to me about something he had seen. I don't recall that specifically, but one of the things we discovered as we were looking back at the facts of that time is there seemed to be coincidence after coincidence after coincidence of an event in Leader and a parallel event in Facebook. And it, to a mathematician, that starts to get, you see patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And we then started looking at the functionality in the first version of Facebook. And lo and behold, it was exactly the same functionality as was described in the white paper.
Hmm. Very interesting.
We then start looking at when our technology was published, and magically that same month, Facebook, and this is very public information, adds the groups functionality at the very time when our groups functionality was disclosed in the first publishing of our patent.
Yeah, that was in July of 2004, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So as we've marched down through this calendar, it it became more than just uncanny. It became a situation where mathematically it's more likely that yours and my DNA matches than he didn't copy our technology.
Wow.
So that was our first real suspicion that something was amiss here.
Yeah. Mike, we're going to have to take a quick commercial break. If you will stay with me, and listeners, stay with us, we will be back to continue this story.
Shaquille O'Neal for new Icy Hot Advanced Cream.
I know all about living with pain. After 19 years of pro ball, man. But now I'm feeling awesome. New Icy Hot Advanced Relief is the real deal.
Icy Hot Advanced Cream has two maximum strength ingredients to last up to 50% longer. Works great on shoulders, backs, knees, even arthritis. Icy to dull the pain and hot to relax it away.
Come on now. Advance past pain and get on with living.
New Icy Hot Advanced. Available in cream and patch.
Pain over.
Use only as directed.
Start life over. Spend more quality time with your family. Take more vacations. Own your own business. Be healthy and earn the kind of income you've always dreamed of. Is it possible? Yes, with Youngevity. First, you've got to see the video that is turning the medical industry upside down. Go to HealthyBody13.com. That's HealthyBody13.com. Watch this video, then pre-register for the Spring Longevity Convention May 2nd through 4th in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Hi,
and guess
Dr.
who will
Joel
be there?
Wallach,
Hi, this is Dr. Corey Gold. I'm taking the Healthy Body Challenge, and I'll be there.
I'm Vanessa Hunter, VP of Marketing here at Longevity. I'm taking Longevity's the Healthy Body Challenge, and I'll be there.
Hi, this is Joyce Riley. I'm taking the Healthy Body Challenge, and I'll be there.
Take the Healthy Body Challenge and don't miss the Longevity Convention in Las Vegas, Nevada, May 2nd through 4th. For more information, go to HealthyBody13.com or call 1-800-360-8695. That's 800-360-8695.
Hi, I'm Pamela Fugit-Hetrick, the host of Money Moves. Cash flows and money moves, but do you find money moving out of your wallet faster than it comes in? Do you wish you had a personal money manager? Do your best Dirty Harry imitation.
You've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, Bunk?
Go ahead. Make my day.
Pretend that your finger is your gun. Quick draw, aim, point, and straight ahead. Notice that one finger is pointing out, but you have at least three pointing back at you. You're the best person to manage your own money. To get the tools you need for the job, listen to Money Moves Thursday night from 7 to 8 p.m. As your host, I promise that each week, Money Moves will leave you with some tips and tools to help you manage your own money. Thursday nights, 7 p.m. for Money Moves. Remember, that's Thursday nights, 7 p.m. for Money Moves.
Thank you.
This segment brought to you by User Friendly Computing for all your computer service needs. Give them a call today at 423-9653 or stop on by the shop at 505 River Street in Santa Cruz. And be sure to ask Peter for your free $50 diagnostic coupon.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for staying tuned in today. We are talking about the Leader versus Facebook case with Mike McKibben, the CEO of Leader Technology. Mike, are you still with me? Mike, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, okay, good. So let's pick up the story. So, Mike, Facebook is launched in February of 2004. Leader's patent application publishes in June of 2004. We see that Jim Breyer invests $12.5 million in Facebook. Then Leader's patent is awarded in November of 2006, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Now, you then file patent infringement lawsuit against Facebook in November of 2008.
That's correct.
Okay. So that's when it began.
That's when the Leader v. Facebook case began, yes.
Okay, and your trial began on July 19th of 2010. Now, this
That's
is
correct.
A very, very interesting trial, Mike, and why don't you tell us about the verdict?
The verdict was a surprise.
Mm-hmm.
It was a split verdict. There are a number of things about the case that, looking back, were odd. One of them was the way the case was split up, and we only did part of the trial. We only did the infringement portion of the trial. We didn't do the damages, the willful infringement, and the injunction part of the trial. The judge split those off and said, we'll do those later if we find infringement.
Okay.
So we did the infringement portion of the trial, and we received a split verdict in that Facebook was guilty on 11 of 11 counts, as you said earlier, of literally infringing our patent, which is the highest form of infringement. There was also a decision that there was no prior art. Contrary to the great hue and cry out in the blogosphere that we were patent trolls and things like this,
yes.
Facebook and their friends were unable to put up even one piece of prior art that would otherwise knock our patent claims out. And then the part of the trial that went against us was something called on sale bar. And this is the very obscure law that deals with the fact that you're not allowed as a patent, somebody who's developing a patent, you're not allowed to start selling your patent more than a year before you file for the patent,
mm-hmm.
roughly speaking. There's some nuances there.
Okay.
But basically, that's the concept. And the jury decided that we had tried to sell it too soon. And this was a surprise to our attorneys, since Facebook didn't even put up an expert witness on that subject. They were completely relying on several pieces of doctored evidence, and they convinced the jury somehow to rule against us on that piece. And that's called an invalidity verdict, which technically invalidates the claim in the patent trial for those particular claims in our patent against Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't invalidate your patent for other infringers, but it does for that trial. So we appealed that. So, and then the appeal process then is where we encountered an enormous amount of misconduct. But that's how the patent went. So it was a split decision.
Okay, but within that on sale bar issue, wasn't some of the jurors' information redacted?
Yeah, there were two pieces of evidence the judge said were the basis of the on sale bar verdict,
mm-hmm.
in his opinion. And one of them was something called interrogatory number 9. And interrogatories, it's a fancy name for, they put a, before a trial, you get a set of questions and you answer them.
Right.
You're interrogated.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so we had answered a set of questions related to our technology in 2009, which was the basis of the question. We were ordered by the judge to answer in the present tense for what was the nature of our product in 2009. When Facebook presented that information to the jury, they actually literally blocked out about 60% of that interrogatory, and that's what was shown to the jury.
Wow, Mike, isn't that jury tampering?
Well,
worst?
You can call it whatever you want.
It seems to me that would be a mistrial when you tamper with jury information. I don't know how they were able to get away with that. Do you?
The judge approved it.
The judge approved it.
Our attorneys objected,
mm-hmm.
and asked that the whole interrogatory be shown, and the judge overruled it and allowed Facebook to present just the doctored pieces.
My goodness, that's
so that was one of the two pieces, and then the other piece was a really small snippet of my 2 days of videotaped testimony, where I was answering questions about our product, and Facebook took a section of it out of context, and then the judge said the combination of those two pieces of evidence constituted clear and convincing evidence that we had tried to sell it too soon.
Oh, my goodness.
And again, they did. That was the basis of the evidence. There was no expert testimony. There was no third-party testimony. There was no engineer testimony, no nothing.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't allowed to go out and interview the people that we allegedly tried to sell it to, and that was another anomaly in this trial. The judge that actually heard the case at trial was not the judge in this case until 3 months before trial.
Right. There was an original – yeah, judge – right.
And we had a 25-plus year judge, Judge Farnan, before that. And then, for some reason, he decides 3 months before the trial to resign and retire. And then Judge Stark comes in. And this was after the close of discovery. Now, maybe people who are not familiar with litigation don't know what discovery is. But discovery is where you ask the other side to give evidence and you give evidence. And so essentially the idea of a just trial is you're supposed to have all the facts there so that when you put those facts before the jury, they can make a fair decision.
Mm-hmm.
That's the principle, and that's the role of discovery. Well, after Judge Stark came on this case, Facebook changed their claims and added this on-sale bar claim after the close of discovery.
Huh.
So when that happened, we wanted additional discovery, and the judge blocked that. We were not allowed to do any more discovery to prepare our defenses for this new accusation.
My goodness. Well, Mike,
that's why there was no other evidence. There was no expert.
Yeah. We'll get to those judges in a moment, but I'm trying to stick with the chronological order here, and I hope people are understanding what we're saying here. Facebook then files an S-1 public offering disclosure, and in doing that, there was no mention of the trial or impending appeals or anything. They just completely didn't mention it.
That's right.
That's a very interesting thing, don't you believe? That they wouldn't have to mention that with all of this going on?
Well, I can tell you that numerous securities people that I know think it's unusual not to disclose something like that. But there are lots of ways to finesse wording in a disclosure, and I guess they felt like they had done what they needed to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now you get this... You are going to appeal this, correct? This decision that was made, you guys decided to appeal it.
Yes.
Okay, tell us the story about the only news show that did carry the story, which was Fox News Business, and what occurred during that interview there prior, while you were in the appealing process, you thought.
Well, when you appeal a patent case, unlike appeals in other jurisdictions, all patent cases at the federal level are appealed to the Federal Circuit, which is a special court in Washington, D.C. that handles all patent trials, appeals on all patent trials. So we appealed to the Federal Circuit, and we that appeal was denied. In other words, they did not overturn the jury. We argued that, hey, this interrogatory and this piece of snippet of testimony does not constitute clear and convincing evidence. They said it does. And so then we got that decision, and then we appealed for a rehearing, which is the next step.
Okay.
So you basically say, come on, look at this again.
Mm-hmm.
And so while that rehearing was pending, a decision on the rehearing was pending, I got contacted by Fox Business to do a live interview on national television, which was something that I did like a week later. So in the interview, I was informed by Shabani Joshi, the interviewer, that our appeal for rehearing was denied.
Wow.
Now, this was 3 days before our own attorneys got notice that it had been denied.
How can that be, Mike? How would they know before your attorneys or you were notified?
Well, when I asked them that, they said we don't disclose our news gathering sources.
My goodness. This is very, very, very interesting. So that's where it stands. Am I right? Or did the Supreme Court deny the hearing? That is what they did. That's where you stand now. Is that correct?
Well, that rehearing was to the Federal Circuit.
Okay.
We then filed what's called a writ of certiorari, which
Supreme
is basically
Court.
Appeal to the Supreme Court that gets hundreds of those in every grouping that they consider. They chose not to hear the case. So that's where it stands right now.
Mm-hmm. So they chose not to hear it. Something of this magnitude, they chose not to hear it.
Right.
And they can just do that.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, then let's get a little bit of information of what you found out about the federal court judges and their perhaps having some kind of a connection to Facebook with owning tremendous amounts of shares of Facebook stock. A little bit of a conflict of interest, I would think. But you want to tell us what you discovered?
Well, I have several hundred shareholders, and these people are not unsophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my responsibilities is to advocate for their position. I mean, these people took real risk back in the late 90s to support us, to put in that $10 million to invest, to get those 145,000 man-hours to invent what obviously is a very valuable piece of technology.
Mm-hmm.
I have got a group of hundreds of people who are fit to be tied by the treatment that we're getting in the justice system. So I had numerous ones of them start digging on their own because they smelled a rat.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, this new information started occurring, and the first place that this emerged was from the judicial financial disclosures, which every federal judge is required to submit every year that discloses their financial holdings.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, on several of the judges' reports were holdings in funds that were well-publicized major shareholders in Facebook prior to the IPO.
My goodness. And that was all three of the judges, correct?
To my knowledge, mm-hmm. two of the three.
Okay, two of the three.
But the others have asked that the judges disclose their financial holdings, and the rules are that a judge and the extended family cannot hold stock in a company that the judge is hearing. That's the rule.
Yeah.
With the code of conduct.
Mm-hmm.
When the judges were asked to disclose their Facebook holdings, they refused to reply.
And they can just get away with doing that, Mike?
You know what? I'm not sure anybody understands the answer to that question.
I mean, this is almost like a Hollywood movie. that this is occurring in our country, because really what is frightening to me, Mike, as an American citizen, is this whole issue of property rights. This was your intellectual property. But if they can take that away from you, what is the next property right that we are all vulnerable for? In other words, we're all in this game here. And exactly. If you cannot trust the judicial system, who do you trust?
Well, you mentioned property rights.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot of people don't understand exactly what a patent is, so maybe a little example would help.
Okay.
A patent is an intellectual property right. In other words, I've described something in words for something that might or might not be physical. And with software, it's just people know the results of software because they can see it on a screen, but they don't know what's going on behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
But I call those the gears and the pulleys of software. So software can be described just as clearly as if I've got an invention with a bunch of gears and pulleys behind the cover.
Mm-hmm.
And so a patent is very similar to a deed to or a title to your property. You know, when you buy a piece of land, you do a survey, and they lay out the borders of that land, and then if you've properly purchased that, you hold the title to that property. That's your property.
Mm-hmm.
And so a deed, in a sense, is a title to an idea that is unique and that the government has said is unique and is willing to let you have a 20-year monopoly on that idea to encourage more inventors to publish more of these ideas so the public can benefit.
Right.
So when you need to protect your property, essentially what happened is Facebook parked right in the middle of our property on our land,
mm-hmm.
and started using it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so we went to the courts to say, hey, they're using our property, and these courts just turned a blind eye.
My gosh. Well, that explains it on a level I think that we can all relate to, Mike. Thank you for that.
Sure.
I'm going to have to take another quick break. We will pick up the conversation when we come back. Stay with us, folks.
Joining me is Rob Martin. Rob is a health radio host, and he's a product developer, and we're going to be talking about the latest advances to fight hair loss with a natural product, and it's called Provium.
Good morning, Rosemary. Pleasure being with you.
Good to have you here with us. A product developer, you actually look at what the market is looking for in terms of developing a product?
We're constantly looking at the research in all areas of nutraceuticals, cosmeceuticals, natural ingredients. And then, of course, we keep our eye on the needs of people, what the market is asking for. It's a combination of those things.
Okay, so then what is Provium?
It's an all-natural scalp treatment for thinning hair. And it's really a breakthrough because all of us are looking for things to thicken our hair as we age, men and women. And we like to use natural products if we could find one that works rather than using the pharmaceuticals that have side effects. And so now we have a product that actually in clinical testing, you know, has been shown to reduce premature hair loss and thinning hair. By improving the hair root health, the bulb of the hair, it increases blood flow to the scalp. It brings key nutrients to the follicle, keeping the follicle healthy. That's very important, and the testimonials we get are really astounding.
So do you have a special offer for my listeners for me today?
We certainly do, Rosemary. Today, when you order Provia, you're going to get a free month's supply with your order. This is a risk-free, totally guaranteed offer. So you buy one, you're going to get a free one with your order. And I have a special number for your listeners, 800-525-6912. Provia for hair loss, hair thickening, 800-525-6912.
Cool. Well, I appreciate your time today, Rob. Thank you very much.
I enjoy being on your program.
loud. It is raucous. It is fun. So get up and go for it. Take the family. Take the friends. Take the entire neighborhood to the rip-roaring racing fun at Ocean Speedway in Watsonville.
Friday night, it's Ocean Sprints Night number 3 at Ocean Speedway. Buckle your safety harness because we're racing 360 sprint cars, four bangers, American Sox, BAD dwarf cars, wingless sprints, adults $17, seniors $16, and kids $13. Or get the entire family in for only $55.
Ocean Speedway is located at the Santa Cruz County Fairgrounds, just 2 miles east of downtown Watsonville on Highway 152. Get up and go for the loud, raucous, rip-roaring racing fun this Friday night at Ocean Speedway.
Welcome back, everybody. We are speaking to Mike McKibben, the CEO of Leader Technologies, in the case of Leader versus Facebook, and we have been talking about the events and how they unfolded. We left with the issue of property rights, which I believe every one of us should really pay attention to this and be very, very concerned about this, because this affects all of us. Now, Mike, let's bring in some of the other players, because what I want to do is try to get the story done in the first hour so we can open up the calls in the second hour and see how people are responding to this amazing story. Okay. And let's start with Larry Summers, who was president of Harvard while Mark Zuckerberg was a student there. He was Obama's top economic advisor, and he was a former U.S. Treasury secretary. And I think Obama appointed him head of the World Bank. Is that correct?
I believe that's what the World Bank records indicate,
yes. Yes. Okay, so tell us how Larry Summers fits into this piece of the puzzle, and I guess we must then talk about the Goldman Sachs $32 billion bailout. I guess we have to bring that in, don't we? It's part of this whole story.
People are. There's a number of people that have been investigating the various connections in behind the story, and every time they follow another trail, it opens up a new area. So the involvement of the people who made Facebook possible is quite a complex story.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Larry Summers is at Harvard. He, according to what I've read, handpicks Mark Zuckerberg, cherry picks him out for this.
Some people have said that. I actually met him at senior day. My son played football at Harvard, and we met and shook hands briefly. But the other aspects of his involvement with Facebook, I think, are just emerging now. So I think there's a number of reporters that are digging into that now.
Good, good. Now, at the time of this bailout, Yuri Milner was partnered with Goldman Sachs, and they received at least $16 billion of U.S. taxpayer funds, and he reappeared 6 months later with bags full of money totaling $3 billion in overseas funds to purchase Facebook insider stock. Something's a little
interesting.
It's starting to get a little bit rotten here. Something is rotten in Denmark here, Mike.
There was a lot of coverage of his emergence on the scene out there your way. So I think a lot of people were surprised and wondered what in the heck's going on. How did all of a sudden a Russian company get involved with Facebook, and where'd that come from? And I know a number of reporters have been digging into that and discovered a World Bank connection to both him and Sheryl Sandberg, who's the chief operating officer at Facebook right now.
Yeah. She is. She was on 60 Minutes about a couple of months ago. The big story of the night was Sheryl Sandberg, who is the chief operating officer at Facebook, is the new model for women. She is the one of the richest women in the world, and she's a player in this as well.
So oh, most definitely.
We've got Summers. We've got Sandberg. We've got Yuri Milner. We've got, who else? There's quite a list of players here that seem to have an investment in this whole Facebook phenomenon.
Well, the Facebook story has morphed and evolved and changes. Now we learn that some of the key players in LinkedIn were involved with Zuckerberg, even going back to his Harvard days, specifically Reid Hoffman, who is the CEO of LinkedIn now.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Peter Thiel.
Yes.
Thiel. I'm mm-hmm. not sure how you pronounce
it. T-H-I-E-L. Uh-huh. Peter Thiel.
Right. So he was a financier during that summer, that first summer, and that's well-known, well-publicized. He financed Mr. Zuckerberg with $500,000. And, you know, I've spent my life raising money and talking to venture capitalists, or my business life anyway, and either this guy is one genius at raising money and relationships, or something else was going on, because he has lived one blessed life ever since he left the Harvard campus.
Mm-hmm.
And I've talked to many entrepreneurs, and they say, yeah, I don't see how that's possible unless there's another story undercurrent here, and that appears to be what's going on.
Well, it's interesting, this connection to Russia. I think that's a very interesting piece of the puzzle here, and their owning so much of this Facebook stock.
Right.
Also, my understanding, as of April 1, 2013, patent offices cites presidential privilege to block a leader versus Facebook Freedom of Act.
Right.
Information Act. What in the world? How is our president now involved in this scheme of things, Mike?
I have no idea. But one of our more irate shareholders filed for a Freedom of Information Act request from the Patent Office to find out what's going on, because there are certain things occurring at the Patent Office to try to continue to try to invalidate our patent, that our patent prosecutors, that's what you call somebody who files a patent for you, have never seen in their careers, and these are some of the most experienced people in the country. And so these particular shareholders started inquiring, and every time they asked questions, they received more vague responses, obfuscation, and then his last request came back with this appeal to a presidential privilege, and we go, what?
Mm-hmm.
That was very surprising.
Yeah. Although President Obama, I think part of his ability to win his elections were contributed to the technology of Facebook. I think that's how he got – I think he's got 35 million Facebook followers.
Well, every demographic person in the country involved with politics knows that that's mm-hmm. true.
Yeah. So now we have – all the way up through the judicial branch to the executive branch, some real question marks as to how all of this makes any sense to what happened to you with your patent.
Right.
And there are no easy, good answers, Mike, except something feels very wrong here.
At this stage, the best thing that can be done is to put the facts out there.
Mm-hmm.
And people are going to have to draw their own conclusions as to what they mean.
Yeah.
And that's what our supporters are working to do, is get the facts out there.
Yeah. But you haven't been able to get this anywhere where the majority of the people in the country can hear it. They can hear the facts, right? They're just not covering this story, as though they're not covering many of the stories in this country today.
Well, I can't count anymore the number of people who call here and say, I can't believe I'm not hearing about this case in the mainstream media.
Right.
And at this stage, we just sort of make a joke about it that it's all we hear are crickets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whenever this subject comes up.
Well, it seems to be the way it is today with the media, and it's very disturbing to many of us because there are a lot of stories that aren't being talked about that we feel are very important, yours being one of them. So all I can say is it's a very, very interesting story, and it isn't over yet. I'm sure you have a game plan. I know you won't share that plan with us, and I don't blame you, but I hope it will be successful, whatever it is that you endeavor to do going forward, because this is really awful.
Well, you know, we're Americans, and we try to rely on a just system.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that's not happening right now is we're not seeing our courts apply the law fairly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all we ask for is a fair shot.
Right.
And everything about this case from the end of the trial through the appeals has been judges looking the other way and ignoring things and decisions that they've made hundreds of times, maybe not hundreds, but 10, 20, 30 times in other cases. And we're finding in each case, our case becomes an outlier for what they normally do. So after a while, you start putting the pieces together and you realize there's another agenda here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very, very, very obvious. And I hope that in time you will be able to get to the bottom of it. I really do.
Well, we're hoping that those that know what's going on in their various capacities will believe at some point that maybe their personal self-interest and, you know, maybe they've received a good payout is not as important as supporting a sound justice system in this country.
Yes. Gosh. Without that, what do we have? I mean, we're all so vulnerable. We're all at risk.
Well, you know, business can't conduct itself if there's shifting sand underneath. If there's no foundation to fair contracts, fair patents, fair property rights, then business deteriorates because entrepreneurs and business people have to spend all their time dealing with regulation and breaches of lawyers and things like this instead of producing something.
Yes. Well, Mike, I'm going to have you hold right there. We're almost at the top of the hour, and we will pick this up with your calls when we come back. But I wanted to make a couple of announcements. Freedom Forum is going to be hosting next Wednesday night at 1900 17th Avenue. The agent for Tax Truth, John Bannister, the first whistleblower who stood up to the IRS corruption, will be the speaker. I hope you will all come down and we'll learn something from John. I also want to thank Mark for dropping off some wonderful bumper stickers for me last week here at the station. They're wonderful, Mark, and he has a website now, progunbumperstickers.com. Check it out.
Let me check that
out.
I haven't seen that.
Here's one of them. Yeah, we should flood our streets with these bumper stickers to bring the attention. They are either pro Second Amendment. There's a lot of pro Constitution bumper stickers. Anyway, Mark, they're great. So check out his website. And we will be back after the top of the hour with Mike, and I hope you will call in and give us your thoughts and comments on what you've heard for the past hour. You have been listening to KSCO 1080 here in Santa Cruz, and we will be back.